MacCast, Friday, August 31st, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you here with me for another episode. We've got some good stuff to get into this week. Of course, more rumors surrounding the upcoming announcements from Apple. iPhone 5 rumors, or new iPhone, I guess is really what I think they're going to be calling it, along with iPad mini rumors. Also, we have some new Mac rumors in the news this week, so stay tuned for that. And then a little bit of follow-up on some of the patent war comments I made on the last episode, as well as some hints and tips and tricks and all the good stuff we normally get to here on the MacCast. But before I get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors. We have a new sponsor this week, SquareTrade. Many of you know my horror story of leaving my iPhone and my iPad on top of my car and driving off. Needless to say, they were destroyed. I had no extra coverage. I just was under my standard AppleCare warranty. And of course, that meant I was potentially on the hook for the full replacement cost of both those devices, which could be upwards of, say, for the iPhone, $650 to $850. Now, I know I talked about Apple's out-of-warranty coverage program, and I was lucky and able to get my device replaced under that, but that's not always guaranteed. The Apple Store has some discretion to implement that, and even when they do, I still was out of pocket several hundred dollars. And that's where SquareTrade comes in. They offer affordable extended warranty coverage that's going to cover drops, water damage, and it will replace your device should something horrific, like my experience, befall it. It could be anything. It could be your kid playing with it and they drop it. It could be you're leaning over and it falls in the toilet. Whatever it might be, they're going to get your back. And I know that also carriers often have extended coverage, but they usually charge a monthly fee for the life of your contract. So $10 a month, you could be looking at almost $240 for the life of the plan. And SquareTrade is offering something much more affordable. They're offering 2 years of full coverage right now for just $99. That's even lower than their normal $124 price. And I know another concern when you get extended warranty plans is that the whole process for actually getting replacement or taking advantage of your coverage can sometimes be difficult, but SquareTrade makes that easy as well. You can take your device to an Apple store, you can take it to a local repair shop should something happen, get it fixed, and then just take the receipt, scan it, send it to SquareTrade, and they will mail you a check. Or they have overnight free shipping. You send it to SquareTrade and they'll take care of it. So they got your back on these warranty coverages. And plus, it's not just your iDevices. It's not just iPhones. It's not just iPads. They also have plans for laptops, cameras, TVs, appliances, bunch of stuff. You can check them out today. Go to squaretrade.com/MacCast. Give them a look, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So over the past couple of weeks, we've gotten a lot of the, I guess, speculated features and specifications of the next generation iPhone. But one of the rumors that's been in sort of contention is which chip Apple is going to feature in the new device. Well, this week, a researcher from 9to5 Mac, Sonny Dixon, posted a photo that may possibly put that debate to rest. It's of the iPhone mainboard, logic board, and prominently positioned in that picture. You know, of course, it's one of those grainy, blurry kind of pre-release pictures, but you can see it right there is an A6 processor. Now, those rumors have been bouncing back and forth that Apple may go with a modified A5X chip like they have in the new iPad. It could, though, possibly be a new quad-core chip that they would call the A6. Now, the legitimacy of this photo is in question, but I would assume that Apple has been testing both designs and has plans to cover both scenarios. I think what ends up being in the actual device probably will have a lot to do with whether or not they can get the power, performance, and battery life trade-offs that they want, especially considering that it's pretty well understood we'll see a 4G LTE chipset in the new device, the updated screen, a little bit larger, integrated graphics to probably better support that screen, and the thinner design, which means less space for battery, might mean that Apple ends up having to go with a tweaked A5X dual-core processor, and that really wouldn't surprise me. It's actually where I'm kind of falling on this rumor. I don't think Apple's going to put the quad-core in there, because I think performance is fine with an A5X. The software's tweaked enough, and I think Apple's going to opt on the side of having better battery life in the new device. But that's just my own speculation. As far as when we'll see that device, we will know details on September 12th, at least according to most of the rumors we've been hearing. That's all but confirmed that Apple will be having the special event on that date. Also at that event, we should see the final details of iOS 6, and we did get a mention this week of a new AirPlay feature, something they're calling AirPlay Direct, which would be very interesting. It would be a version of AirPlay that would let you send audio directly from device to device. So say from your iPhone or your iPad directly to a set of AirPlay speakers or an AirPlay receiver without the need for connecting to a Wi-Fi local area network or base station. So it's not clear at this point whether AirPlay Direct would be just audio or also include video, but that would be an awesome update in addition to AirPlay and something I hadn't heard about yet with iOS 6. So we should know in a couple weeks, but some exciting updates likely to happen at that event. And just a couple weeks after that event, it's expected that we're going to get the iPad mini announcement along with probably some of the music stuff, new iPod Touch, new iPod Nano. And there has been, of course, the typical rumor build up to that. We've been talking a lot about it on the MacCast. But this week, the iPad mini reportedly showed up over on Instapaper's servers. This is according to the lead developer, Marco Armont. He says that their logs show two previously unseen iPad models showing up, and that it could be Apple's engineers testing the new devices ahead of launch. The models were identified as iPad 2.5 and 2.6, and while those identifiers could easily be spoofed, especially from a jailbroken device, Armont noted that they've seen these kinds of things show up in their logs prior to other launches, and in most of those cases, they turned out to be legitimate, so they're kind of putting a lot of confidence behind this rumor, or at least Armont is. He speculates that the two models are a Wi-Fi version and a GSM model, which is interesting because that would be 3G, and that we have yet to see a CDMA one, which might logically be labeled iPad 2.7. Now, 9 to 5 Mac seems to think that Apple won't go with 3G, and they say that 4G LTE is more likely on a new iPad mini, but that Apple might tack on a premium for that chipset on the lower cost device. So you're looking at $349 versus the rumored $249. As far as specs for the iPad mini, it's largely believed that they're going to mirror the iPad 2 just in a smaller form factor. So you're looking at an A5 chip with 512 megabytes of RAM and a slightly improved GPU to help run that 7.85-inch 1024 by 768 display. Now, the beauty of that screen size and that display resolution is that it would be exactly the same pixel dimensions as the iPad 2, just shrunk down, meaning that all the existing applications would work without the developers having to do any tweaks. And so that, I think, is a big play for Apple and gives them a leg up on the competition, not just from form factor and price point standpoint, but the fact that day one, you're going to have native applications built for that size all ready to go, 650,000 plus of them that are on the App Store. As for where those new displays will be coming from, Bloomberg says they've confirmed that it's going to be AU Optronics and LG making those. And it still is believed that Apple's going to be aggressively targeting a low price point for the tablet. As I mentioned, $249 to $300 is the price range being thrown around. And the launch for that event should be, according to most sources, happening sometime in the first or second week of October. And as I think we talked about on the last show, the fall timeframe this year for Apple releases is getting very, very crowded. It's about to get even more crowded because this week we're getting word of a possible iMac refresh happening in the same time frame. This is because availability of 27-inch iMacs at third-party retailers is apparently dwindling, with some locations actually being sold out, according to checks done by Mac Rumors and Apple Insider. The belief right now is that Apple is getting set to update the iMac models with new versions featuring Intel Ivy Bridge processors. If you remember, a couple weeks ago, we talked about the fact that there were some references noted in Mountain Lion that seemed to contain indicators of a as-yet-unreleased iMac model. It was being labeled 13,0. It was also noted in the same area that there was also references to potentially a new Mac Pro model labeled 6,0. That would be the one, supposedly, that Tim Cook had alluded to earlier in the year. There have been reports also of iMac models showing up on the performance testing site Geekbench. In their logs, they have seen 13,2 model iMacs, I believe, running with, I think, 3.1 gigahertz Intel processors, next generation Intel processors. Now, one analyst is claiming that the iMac was supposed to be due out a little bit earlier, so it wouldn't be on such a crowded schedule, but said that due to some production issues and delays, it's kind of being forced into the time frame along with the new iPhone and the iPad mini releases. The belief is that Apple may also update the 13-inch MacBook Pro, bringing the 13-inch Retina display to that line, and the iMac and the 13-inch MacBook Pro are expected to be announced or be released sometime in the September timeframe. I would imagine that would be more of a soft launch, that Apple's not going to hold a big special event. Likely we'll see the typical scenario where the App Store goes down overnight and the new models then show up along with a press release. And it might not just be the iMacs that are having problems with production delays or production issues. We also heard this week that Sharp might be having a hard time producing some of the iPhone 5 screens, at least at the cost that they thought they could. A lot of it probably to do with the new in-plane technology. It's ending up costing a little bit more than Sharp had initially projected, and I guess they've been warning Apple of potential shortages unless they can get a little bit more money to beef up production. Now, that all sounds a little bit like potential. I don't want to just accuse Sharp of anything, but doesn't it sound a little bit like a move where they go, you know, we can make those panels for you, just give us the contract. Apple gives them the big contract, and then after the fact they go, hey, you know, we got that contract and that's great, but hey, wouldn't it be a shame if anything happened now to kind of slow down the release of those new iPhones and cause any shortages with those shipments? Yeah, and oh, by the way, we could use a little bit more money. Yeah, again, I'm not saying that's what's happening, but doesn't it feel a little bit like that? You know, Apple's on the hook now, and they've got to meet demands. Otherwise, you know, they're not going to be able to ship to all those countries they want to ship to. So I think Sharp's got them behind the eight ball on that one. And I think I said this in the last MacCast, but it's even bigger now. The next couple months are going to be huge, exciting, busy, and potentially very expensive for all of us Apple fans. But I'm looking forward to it nonetheless. And then finally for this week, Apple's org chart went through a little bit of reorganization this week. Two of Apple's vice presidents have been promoted to senior VP positions. Cred Federighi, Apple's vice president of Mac software engineering, was promoted to senior vice president of Mac software engineering. And Dan Riccio, Apple's vice president of hardware engineering, was promoted to senior vice president of hardware engineering. And both men now will be reporting directly to Apple CEO Tim Cook. Now, Riccio is moving into the position formerly held by Bob Mansfield, who had announced back in June that he would be retiring from Apple. Surprisingly, along with the promotion announcements, it was revealed that Mansfield is actually going to be staying on at Apple, and indeed his photo has returned to the Apple's executive page on the website. Mansfield's listing simply lists him as senior vice president, but actually doesn't reveal any division. It's being reported, though, that he will be working on future projects under the guidance of Tim Cook. So Apple's still got the same strong executive team. Mansfield's back on board, I guess, working on some cool new stuff, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that probably next year. I don't think Apple can jam any more stuff into the fall announcements. I'm going to beg them, Apple, please, no more stuff, no more stuff. I'm going to have my work cut out for me in the fall, but it's all good. It's a lot of fun. So stay tuned for all of that. But that is the news for this week. I've got a little bit of follow up here at the top of the show. I had talked a bit about my thoughts on the whole patent war thing in light of the Apple and Samsung verdict, and that elicited this response from Bob.
Hi, Adam. My name is Bob Erdley. I just had a comment about, on your last podcast, you talked about the patent wars, and as much as I don't like legal battles and all the energy and all the time that's taken to go through legal issues, you know, I think if we could come to agreement faster in business, that we really could save a lot of money. And really, with that said, the patent kind of stuff, I think you made a statement that when Apple holds these patents so tightly that it restricts innovation, I think I tend to disagree. I'm not an expert on patents, but I think what patents do, they inspire or they force innovation or they help promote innovation, because sure, the same thing doesn't get created over and over again. You know, what companies need to be doing is they need to be looking at the iPad and looking at the iPhone and coming out with something that is that improves the iPhone, not just another iPhone, you know, and put a Samsung stamp on it. Or they need to come out with something that's new and that's different enough that Apple can't go after them with a patent, but is better and really makes Apple stay on their game and coming out with something that's better than what they just came out with. And I think that's exactly what Apple did with the iPhone. Instead of coming out with something like a Palm Pilot or a BlackBerry, which was, you know, really the smartphone of the time, they came out with something new and better, and they talked about the shortcomings of the BlackBerry or the smartphone, you know, the stylus and having to push keys on a keypad and stuff like that. They took that idea and made a really smartphone. And now, you know, now the call, I think, needs to go out to all these other companies. Okay, what is the next smartphone or the next, you know, iPad kind of device or something like that?
Hey, Bob, you know, I would tend to actually agree with a lot of the statements you were making there. And I think originally you would be correct. I mean, patents are out there. They were designed when they were first thought up to do exactly what you're describing, to protect innovation, to give somebody who comes up with a truly unique and original idea the ability to protect that idea. And that does, I think, absolutely. And that spirit foster innovation. You can go out and you can create something new and not have to be afraid that someone's going to come along and just make a copycat. The problem is I think that idea and that concept in our current times has been watered down and diluted and been commandeered for a different purpose. And that's sort of what I was talking about and reacting to in this scenario. I think it's rarely the case that that is how patents are being used anymore. It's now individuals and companies building up these large patent war chests, and for them, it's all about potentially gaining licensing. and making money off of those patents. And that's in some ways what's happening with Apple, right? They're having Google license their stuff. Google's going to now license Apple stuff. I think this week there came out an announcement that Apple and Google's CEOs are in talks to try and settle and take care of some of this patent stuff. But it's all going to be about money changing hands. So it has very little to do with protecting the innovations. It's just, and we're going to sell our innovations to them and they'll sell their innovations to us. And neither of us necessarily has to innovate, or we can let the small guy innovate and then, you know, buy up his patent and then just use it. So, you know, maybe I just don't get it that it's really doing that spirit of fostering that thing. And like you mentioned in your voicemail, it seems like we're spending an awful lot of time in courtrooms and time and effort and money on doing those things. You know, I do think in Apple's case that they truly did innovate and they truly want those patents to protect their innovations more in the spirit of the original patents, because they're one of the few companies in my mind that's truly out there coming up with new stuff. I call it disruptive innovation, right? Apple doesn't want to do what everybody else has done before. They go and look at a market and see where can we change things and where can we make an impact. But they're being forced to play and participate in the other side of this whole patent situation. And to me, that's what ultimately may stifle this kind of innovation. And it's especially true, I think, if you're a small guy who has a truly innovative idea, but you might end up being blocked by a broad patent. That's another part of this equation, is I think more and more we're allowing companies to get patents that are just way too broad. I think the example that Samsung made is, you know, Apple kind of, in some ways, got a patent on a rounded rectangular thing, right? If it's got a screen on it and it's shaped like a rounded rectangle, then nobody else can make something like that. And I don't know that shape is necessarily innovative or changed a lot of things. Now, there's all that artwork that shows phones before the iPad or before the iPhone and after the iPhone, and tablets before the iPad and after the iPad. And yes, there's a huge difference. And before, things looked different. Afterward, everybody seems to be kind of making the same thing. But in my mind, there are some physical limitations too. Like once you've defined what a tablet is, and we've seen those tablets, as I mentioned in that episode too, in Star Trek, right? Star Trek had iPads. I think Samsung pointed to the 2001 A Space Odyssey. So science fiction has thought up these ideas a long time before. The only mistake that Gene Roddenberry made is he didn't patent the pad. And had he, Apple would be paying him big licensing fees. So, you know, I don't know. It can get all a little bit convoluted, and I guess I get frustrated by that. I understand how we got to where we are, but I'm not sure that your vision that you're laying out is still the true vision. I think that's where patents started out, but I just don't feel like we're there anymore. So that's how I'm feeling about it. Any of you who want to weigh in on this conversation, if you think I'm crazy, disagree with me, please send your audio comments along. And I want to thank Bob for taking the time to send in those comments. Now, you know the normal way that I get questions and feedback for the MacCast is through emails and through the voicemail line. But occasionally I have an opportunity to get a question from a friend or a colleague or somebody I meet at one of my meetup groups, and they'll ask me a Mac question that's particularly relevant to the show. And often it's going to be something that stumps me and I have to go back and do a little research on. And that happened this week. A friend of mine in my iOS user group at the meeting pointed out a puzzling thing he was noticing on his wife's Mac, and it had to do with list views in Finder in macOS 10 Lion. I think it may have even been in Mountain Lion for him. I think he had recently upgraded and noticed this little issue. And what he was noticing was that some windows in the Finder, when he was in list view, he was able to click on the column headers like you'd expect and sort the results. And from my memory, that was how I remembered it, things working. And most days when I'm in the Finder, I think I can click on the different column headings and they sort. But he was saying that in some instances, he was noticing that the column headers weren't sortable. And even more puzzling, he was saying most of the time when he was connected to an external server, an external volume, or another Mac or PC on his network, column headers were sortable. But when he was just in the regular Finder, they weren't sortable. and this had me puzzled. I was scratching my head, and so I thought I'd do a little research on it. I did a little poking around, and initially I thought, well, maybe this has something to do with search results in smart folders, because I did a spotlight search, and I noticed that, oh, lo and behold, my column headers in the list view weren't sortable. I thought that was puzzling, so I thought, I'll open up just a standard Finder window from the Finder, you know, open up a folder, and hey, the column headers were sortable. And so I was about to respond to him and let him know, I think this has something to do with searching. But then it turned out that I realized, you know, Lion has the whole arrange by option. And I think it was actually part of Snow Leopard. I don't know how far it goes back. But, you know, you have the ability to go and go under the view menu and choose under the arrange by different options. So you can arrange by, you know, date modified, date created. And it sort of resorts the information into these little blocks, into these little sections. And so what I discovered was that if you have gone into a Finder view and you've enabled arrange by options, then the column headers become not sortable, which in a way makes sense because you're sorting already by the arrange by feature. And if you start changing it with the column headers, it's going to mess up your arrange by. So that is what was actually going on. And if you go into that menu and just simply change the arrange by option back to none, and the keyboard shortcut for that is Command Control Zero, do that, boom, the sorting in your columns comes right back. And I have to just mention that I actually love the arrange by feature, and I use it most of the time. So most of my list view column headers are not sortable. And I have the little icon in my toolbar for switching it. And I know in Lion it's there by default, but if you don't see that little arrange by icon in your toolbar, you can go under the view menu in the Finder and choose Customize Toolbar and just drag it up into there and enable it. I think it's a quick, easy way to access it. And there's a bunch of keyboard shortcuts. Command, Control, plus the number keys, 1, 2, 3, 4, will switch between the different views in the Finder in the Arrange By. So you can scroll through those quickly and easily using some keyboard shortcuts. And so that was it. You know, just like one of those things that someone brings up and you spend a little time on and discover an answer. And interestingly, this week, another story that came right out of my real-world life was the report of this new Java exploit, zero-day Java exploit that showed up that could potentially affect Macs. Although, we got to dig in a little bit and talk about really how dangerous it is. But this week, we saw a second high-profile exploit targeting holes in the Java code from Oracle, which used to be Sun. And the big story here was that this latest exploit is for a known security hole that was actually reported back in April. And apparently Oracle had plans to patch it with their October security release, but I guess they pushed the schedule up once this hit the news feeds, and an update actually came out on Thursday on Oracle's website, java.com. And it's a vulnerability in the Java runtime environment, Java 7 version 1.7, which actually for Mac users turns out to be a good thing because very few Mac users actually have Java installed by default. Apple stopped shipping Java out of the box with Mac OS X. And the other thing is that those of us who do actually have an older version installed, version 1.6. So instead of deferring to doing their software updates on their own, Apple now requires you to go to Oracle's website to update your stuff. And so most people haven't updated and we're running 1.6 and the vulnerabilities for 1.7. So you're actually by proxy protected, and you're protected in most cases because most of us don't even have Java installed on our systems. So the other thing that helps Mac users is that even if you do have Java installed, the ability to run Java applets in your browser is also disabled by default. And the most common way you would get taken advantage of with this exploit is by getting a link or going to a malicious website that had a Java applet running on it, and then you'd become infected. But if it's not enabled in your browser, then you're not going to fall prey to the exploit. Now, all this said, is there is some things for those of us who need to run Java and have it installed that we might want to do to better protect ourselves. If you don't need Java, the number one thing you should do is make sure that it is turned off and it's not installed on your system. You want to disable it in your browser, and you also want to disable it overall for your system. To disable it in your browser, if you're using Safari, you go into Safari under Preferences and then just uncheck the Enable Java option in the Security pane. If you're on Firefox, you go to Tools, Add-ons, Plugins, and just make sure that you uncheck the Java plugin. And then Chrome, for whatever reason, it's the trickiest. In Chrome, you need to go into just your browser window, and then right in the URL bar, type chrome:// plugins, and then click the link to disable Java. And once you've disabled it in the browser, you want to disable it for the system as well. If you have Java installed, you'll have the Java Preferences utility, which is in Applications Utilities under Java Preferences. Launch that, and then just make sure that you've unchecked the Enable Applet Plugin and Web Start Applications option, and then also uncheck the On options for the installed versions of Java. So there'll probably be a 32-bit and a 64-bit version of Java installed. Make sure those are unchecked. And you'll also note that in here you can see which version of Java you're actually running. So in my case, mine did show that I was running 1.6. If you've installed 1.7, it would be very obvious from this preference panel. And if you are running 1.7, you're going to want to grab the update that Oracle pushed out on their website at java.com. So if you do need to run applications for Java, and some of us do, I use CrashPlan as my online backup service, and that is a Java application. So I need to be running Java on my system. Also, those of us who maybe have web-based like FTP uploaders that your ISP might require for uploading files to your website, if you don't want to use an FTP client like Transmit, some people like to just do it right in the browser. Those are generally Java applets. Also, some of the remote troubleshooting and remote control apps from different vendors. So these are the things that allow you to remote control another computer. A lot of those rely on Java technology. So if you do need to have Java installed and turned on, there was actually a great tip from Rich Mogul over at Macworld on a little bit safer way that you could do it. And that would be to disable it in all browsers using the process I described earlier, and then go ahead and enable it at the system-wide level. So go into Applications, Utilities, Java Preferences, and turn it back on for the Web Start options. And then use an alternate browser as your main, from your main browser for running your Java stuff. So if your main browser is Safari, maybe consider enabling Java in Chrome and then only using the Chrome browser when you needed to access the services that rely on a Java applet. And that way, you don't have the problem of if you're surfing around in your main browser and you actually click something and go to the wrong site, that suddenly this exploit takes advantage of the Java holes that exist. So I thought that was a really great tip, and I just wanted to point out why we probably, as Mac users, don't really need to worry too much about this latest Java exploit. Another listener of mine was having some issues with his battery. Listener Mike sent me an interesting email about an experience he had at the Genius Bar related to the battery in his 2008 MacBook Pro. He said that he's had the machine since the summer of 2008, and he's used it kind of for light daily use, about 20 hours a week, and overall has taken really good care of the battery, cycling it like he should, you know, not letting it stay charged all the time, not disconnecting it all the time, and the battery had always reported to him having a normal battery status. If you go into your system information, you can kind of check on the health of your battery, see the charge cycles and things like that. And it was always saying normal battery status. And so he was surprised when about a month ago he went to boot up the system and it just wouldn't start. There was no battery whatsoever. The battery was completely dead. So he took it to the Apple Store and they said, yep, your battery's dead. We can give you the standard replacement, which is $129 for a new battery or $99 for a reconditioned battery. At that time, Mike decided that he wanted to look into maybe some third-party options, see if he could find a better deal on a battery, and at that point went home, removed the bad battery and put it on a shelf, and then was running the machine for about a month or so just off of wall power being plugged into the outlet. And then he needed to take the laptop somewhere and decided, I'm going to put the battery back in just so I don't have a big hole in the bottom of my Mac. And went to grab the battery off the shelf and noticed it was completely bulging and swollen. And he felt that, oh, well, there's a defect with the battery. Apple should probably replace it. So he took a trip back to the Genius Bar, and they told him that, again, he could buy a replacement battery, but that his battery wasn't covered, and that the swelling was actually a feature. And that's where this story gets odd, right? Like, where, in what world, and this is why Mike emailed me, in what world would a swelling battery be a feature? And Mike was really felt that it was defective and he was owed a new battery for the swelling. So who's right and, you know, what happened here? And the little background, Apple's batteries are actually, they're lithium ion cells, and they're actually a set of cells that are in these little metal covered envelopes. So if you could pop that open, or if you look at some of these images of swelled batteries, what you'll notice is that the battery case is popped open. And then inside there, there's these little metal pouches that actually have the battery cells in them. And those are linked together with, you know, wiring, and there's circuits in there. And there's also a little logic board that adds to some of the sort of safety features and charging controls and stuff like that. And so what actually causes the swelling is potentially two different effects. You can have extreme heat or extreme discharge cause the swelling. And extreme heat is usually caused by some sort of faulty regulation circuitry. So the battery starts overcharging and then starts to heat up because maybe there's a bad board or the circuits go bad or something like that. Extreme discharging is actually caused by storing a battery without any charge in it. And I think that's what happened in Mike's case. Is that was a dead battery, and then he took it out and put it on a shelf, so there was no current going into that battery. So what happens in that situation is the lithium ion will continue to discharge on its own, and the chemistry that's in there starts to have this reaction, and it starts to build up gas as a byproduct of this reaction, and that's what actually causes these cells to swell up and then is eventually burst out of their case. I mean, it's strong enough, the pressure in there is strong enough to actually force the case apart from the inside. And that's when you see these swollen batteries. So the feature, my best guess at the feature that the genius was alluding to was like, not a feature like, hey, the batteries swell. That's a great feature. No, I think it was a safety feat. It's a safety feature that Apple's kind of built in where they know that these cells have the potential to swell up, and they build that pouch, that casing, to be able to sort of accommodate the gas that builds up in there. And at a certain point, you know, all the material is used up and it'll stop expanding. So they've built it in a way where it's not going to blow up violently, because when that happens, that's when you have these incidents where, you know, someone says my battery blew up and it caused a fire, or I got burnt or something like that. That you don't want to happen. So I think the feature, Mike, is that it doesn't explode. But in your case, you know, that battery has reached the end of life. If it's 2008 was when the original battery was in the unit, lithium ion batteries in most cases tend to have a useful life of about 2.5 to 3.5 years. Some can actually last longer, but I think the problem was just storing that fully discharged battery on the shelf. That's what caused the issue. So Apple's not going to likely cover it. It's not going to be something that they have to replace, and you're going to probably have to just buy a new battery if you want to continue to use that laptop. The only thing that I will say is, because of all the stuff I just mentioned, you want to be careful if you're going to buy a third-party battery. There are good ones out there. You probably want to make sure you buy from a reputable source, or just go with the Apple branded battery, because some cheap, really cheap off-brand batteries might not have a really good circuitry in them that sort of protects against some of this overcharging. Is usually the problem you have if you have a battery that doesn't have good circuitry in it. And I think that's in a lot of cases where we hear about these iPods exploding and stuff like that. Occasionally Apple gets faulty batteries, but, you know, I think in a lot of cases it's somebody bought some off-brand third-party battery that was really cheap, put it in their device, and then it ended up overcharging and then exploded. So be careful with batteries. But yeah, I mean, Apple, that's a consumable part. Had the battery failed while it was under the original AppleCare, or even if you have the 3 years of AppleCare and your battery swells up like that, Apple will probably just replace it. But outside of AppleCare warranty, after 3 years, it's probably just time to get a new one. And then finally today, I got an email with an iPhoto question, or actually a PhotoStream question from Kieran. I hope I got your name right. Well, one of those is probably right. I think it's Kieran. And he had an interesting question about using iCloud's PhotoStream feature with iOS devices, but wanted to know what happens if you've turned on PhotoStream and you don't use Aperture or iPhoto on your Mac. So you can, you know, the question is, can you still get PhotoStream images on your Mac without using one of those applications? And as far as I know, you can actually enable PhotoStream from the system preferences under the iCloud settings. It's just a checkbox there. So I would assume you can turn it on even if you don't have iPhoto or Aperture installed. The question would be then, though, if you turn it on, will it access your PhotoStream and will it download and sync those photos to your Mac somewhere? And it actually, I think, does, because it puts them in your home library folder inside the application support folder in an iLife asset management folder. And then inside that, there's an assets folder and then a folder called sub. And if you go look in there, you'll actually see a bunch of folders with these little cryptic file names. And then inside there are the individual folder of photos, excuse me, from your photo stream. So there's generally one photo per folder, up to 1,000 photos in that directory, because PhotoStream syncs 1,000 photos. And it also syncs the photos from the last 30 days up to 1,000 images. So there could potentially be anywhere from 1 to 1,000 images in that folder. And so I tested this, Kieran, on my Mac to see if, you know, without having iPhoto launched, if the photos would actually show up. So I'm only guessing here because I did have iPhoto installed on my system, but I think this would work even without iPhoto being installed. So for my test, what I did was I went into that folder and I deleted all of the images out of it. And then I turned off PhotoStream from the system preferences and then turned PhotoStream back on. And when I turned it back on, it did actually immediately start putting photos from my PhotoStream back into that directory. Now, when I removed the photos, I removed about 1,000 photos, and I was a little bit concerned because only 15 photos came back from the stream. But then I realized that's normal expected behavior, because those 1,000 images I had built up over a very long time. But the way PhotoStream works is it only syncs photos from the last 30 days. So these were the last photos from the last 30 days, and they came streaming right back in, and they were in that folder, and I had not launched iPhoto or anything at that point. So I don't think iPhoto is required or Aperture is required to get the photos from PhotoStream onto your Mac. I think they'll show up in this folder. The interesting thing about this folder is it does seem to be just a receiving location, and it actually doesn't necessarily automatically clear out even after you've imported photos into an app like iPhoto or Aperture. You'd have to actually delete them from iPhoto to get them to delete out of this directory. So if you're concerned about space on your Mac, you may want to watch this folder. Like I said, when I first went to it, I had the 1,000 images in there. Many of those images I had already imported into my iPhoto library, so I don't necessarily need them in a second location. And I would assume that because PhotoStream has the 1,000 photo limit, that it starts clearing out old photos if it gets above 1,000 for this directory, but I don't even know if that's guaranteed. I actually had 1,001 images in this folder for some reason. But it definitely leaves them there after you import them into iPhoto. So it might be worthwhile to clean out this folder from time to time. And there's a couple ways to do that. One would be just to go to the folder and actually remove the copies. Now, interestingly, cleaning out the images will not remove them from your photo stream. So that's actually a good thing. So you could manually clear out the local copy here and you don't have to worry about stuff being removed from your photo stream. The other way that you can get images out of here is you can actually just go in and turn off photo stream from the iCloud system preferences, and that will remove all the images from the folder. But again, it's not going to remove the photos from your device or from iCloud. If you want to remove the copies that are actually up on Apple servers, the ones that are on iCloud, you actually have to go to iCloud.com. Well, one way you can do it is to go to iCloud.com. If you go to iCloud.com, you can click on your account, and then you can click on Advanced, and from there you'll see an option that says Reset Photo Stream. If you click that button, that will clean out all the photo stream photos from iCloud's servers, but as noted on that page, will not remove them from your Mac or your devices. So if you want to delete a photo from PhotoStream itself and also from the device, then you need to do that from the PhotoStream album either on your Mac or on your device. So you can go in, delete that, and it will warn you, if you delete it here, I'm also going to delete it from your photo stream. And so that's the way to completely clear out photos from your photo stream. So in summary, I do think that you could use photo stream on your Mac without having iPhoto, but you're going to suffer a couple of limitations. One would be that you're not going to have easy access to those images. You're going to have to use that cryptic Home Library Application Support iLife Asset Management Assets subfolder, and you're going to have to look in there and look at all these cryptic folder names and try and figure out where your photos are. Now, that said, I was able to pretty quickly write a simple automator script that would go look in that folder and pull out any JPEG files and actually copy them to a folder. I picked my home folder, my images folder, and just created a photo stream photos folder and had it copy them into there. But you could do that. I looked around and I didn't see any applications that would actually let you directly browse your photo stream folder on your Mac. I think that'd be a nice little utility or application for someone to write for those people who maybe don't want to use Aperture or iPhoto like yourself. But the other limitation you're going to have is you're not going to be able to add photos to the photo stream from your Mac, and also you're not going to be able to remove those photos from the photo stream on your Mac. So you'll just be able to get copies of them out of that folder if you choose not to install Aperture or iPhoto. So there you go. That's how you would do it, and I think it would work. If I end up being wrong on that, I just didn't have a machine I could test on. All of my Macs actually have iPhoto installed on them. So if there's someone out there who can test this theory and let us know what you find out, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, actually, and also check out their new application, iTrash, over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, PDF Pen for iPad, and Text Expander Touch. You can get information on all of their stuff, as well as trials of their Mac applications, over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, you can get cash for your old iDevices. Do a simple search over on gazelle.com and get an offer. And also SquareTrade, protect your iDevices with a warranty that's going to cover drop and water damage. You can get more information and details over at squaretrade.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed, for listening. Please keep your emails and your audio comments coming. I look forward to your comments, your questions. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-622-4269. MacIam9. Leave a voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. And be sure to check out the website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum. You can find all of that at maccast.com. Also, if you'd like, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. And be sure to check out the MacCast Facebook page over on facebook.com/The MacCast. That's going to do it for now. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.